Hey everyone, I'm your host Kevin Kelly. My goal is simple, to bring you behind the scenes with some of today's top investing minds as we explore novel ideas and controversial topic areas to make sense of today's investing environment. If you're not on Delphi's research portal, you're missing out on the critical analysis read by the top minds in the crypto and digital asset space, so be sure to check it out. One quick housekeeping item, nothing said on this podcast is a solicitation to buy or sell any security or token, or to make any financial decisions. I may personally hold securities or tokens mentioned on this podcast, and you can view our show notes below for our complete disclosures. And with that, let's jump into the episode.
Before we jump in, we'd like to thank our sponsors for making this episode possible.
There are several projects building inter-blockchain communication protocols, but there's one that's currently built. Cosmos.network is on a mission to link every blockchain. Well-known projects like Terra, Band, Kava, and Secret use Cosmos and the Cosmos Hub to connect to every other chain in their network. The Cosmos Hub is completed and launched, and you can visit cosmos.network today to check it out. The Cosmos Hub brings us that much closer to Web 3.0, and we thank the Cosmos community for sponsoring the Delphi podcast.
Kava is a cross-chain DeFi platform that gives you the ability to earn more by connecting the world's largest cryptocurrencies, ecosystems, and financial applications in one safe and seamless integration. We're excited for the upcoming launch of the Swap Protocol, a cross-chain AMM liquidity hub bridging DeFi, blockchains, and financial services to swap the world's largest assets and maximize yields across your entire portfolio. Swap will join the Kava protocol and Hart protocol as the next application built on the Kava platform. Celo is a mobile-first platform that makes financial dApps and crypto payments accessible to anyone with a mobile phone, providing the opportunity to positively impact the users of 6 billion smartphones in circulation today. Celo's eco-friendly proof-of-stake consensus mechanism an ultra-mobile light client makes up to 17,000 times faster than other blockchains and accessible to mobile phone users around the world. Visit Celo.org to learn more.
My guest on this episode is Tom Lombardi, Managing Director at 3IQ, the largest digital asset manager in Canada. Tom is also an adjunct professor of finance at Pepperdine University, where he teaches digital asset finance. We originally recorded this conversation several weeks ago, and after re-listening to the topics discussed, I deeply regret not getting this out sooner. But throughout our discussion, Tom weighs in on a wide variety of topic areas, ranging from the rise of DeFi and its growing popularity among institutional investors, to the evolution of liquidity mining programs and how proper token incentives can actually better align stakeholders to create more valuable products than their centralized counterparts. I really enjoyed this conversation with Tom, and I hope you do too. Really quickly, before we get started, just a quick disclaimer. Delphi Ventures is an investor in 3IQ, and everything we discuss in this podcast is intended for informational purposes only. Nothing we say should be construed as investment advice or solicitation to buy any token or security mentioned in this podcast.
The views expressed today in the podcast are my own and not representing 3IQ, affiliate companies, or strategies.
All right. I am joined here with Tom. Tom, thank you so much for being with me today. How are
you? Absolutely, Kevin. Thanks for having me. It's Friday. Let's have some fun.
It's Friday, right? Let's keep it lighthearted. It's Friday. It's a Friday afternoon. What's top of mind for you right now?
Oh, man. Well, you know, we've got day job stuff, the serious stuff. But let's have fun. I mean, what's happening? We had the Iron.finance debacle, the Cuban missile, Mark Cuban missile crisis, I think it was called.
I hadn't heard that, but I love that.
It's great.
Hilarious.
So, you know, bit of background, Iron has this, as a stable coin, which is loosely pegged to, the underlying assets. There's asset Titan, I think the one on Polygon. Something else on Binance Chain. I think it's called Steel. But essentially, you have these governance tokens and you have stablecoin, and they're working together to make a financial market. And, you know, it wasn't, I don't believe it was rugged. I hear that word thrown around a lot. The Binance was audited. I don't think the Polygon finished their audit. But anyways, it was a bank run. And I think that's what the team said. People just liquidated positions, and it's kind of wild.
It operated as expected or as it should, but obviously when you see massive sell-offs like that, the first kind of instinct I think for everybody is it's either a rug or it's a scam.
Right. So just run for the exit. So I think there's two funny kind of sort of observations, right? And one is, like, if you think of the metaphor, like, what if Tether put their treasury on Uniswap.
Right.
And you know, that could expand and collapse as fast as the crypto markets move. They would have a tough time holding their peg or holding, right? And that's essentially what, as I see it, what they were attempting to do, right, with this algo stablecoin. But the other sort of irony of this is that, like, all of the yield farming opportunities, right, providing liquidity for these markets for funding the stablecoin, that's where the earnings were, right? It was like 1,000,000% return. It was the liquidity providers that provided the exit ramp for investors, right? And that's been referenced in other scenarios, but you know, you have people standing by ready to sell at any price, to buy at any price. And when the market moved, I mean, it was just like a death spiral. I watched it in real time for fun. But it's, you know, it was an experiment. You know, unfortunately, like, people got burned. Mr. Cuban, I'm sure he's got some other assets to cover his losses. And I'm sure a lot of other people lost money. But these are experiments, right? And this is a new paradigm. So, you know, let's learn from these experiences. And you know, I think step one is go with the audits, go with reputable audits. And they didn't have theirs yet on Polygon. So if there's anything you can take away from that, is maybe that.
It's kind of interesting too, because when you have such a, we'll call it, level playing field, right? Your Mark Cubans of the world, as we saw, are also susceptible to, you know, this type of, I won't call it necessarily market risk, because that's obviously very idiosyncratic, right, to iron itself. But you have this level playing field, and you have people like Mark Cuban coming in, and I think he's doing a great job of bringing more awareness to the space. He had a great write-up, I don't know if you saw earlier, I think it was this week, around just explaining DeFi and yield farming in very kind of layman's terms, right? And coming from such an influential person and investor like that, I think is doing the space wonders. But it just goes to show that, you know, there is a lot of risk in this market. It pays to do your own research and your own homework. But at the end of the day, you know, he's on the hook, or he's, you know, susceptible to big sell-offs and market risks, just like all of us are.
Even billionaires can get burned, right? I love that. The level playing field works on both sides, right? Like, you know, blockchain is enabling this new sort of, I'll call it like a shadow financial environment, and anyone can participate, right? So for Mr. Cuban, he'll learn lessons as well. And so, anyways, what else? What else am I thinking about? Oh, the other fun one was DYDX, which is, automated market maker. Cool platform, sort of semi-centralized, right? They have a centralized order book, but everything's on chain. I love the marketing tactics. Actually, it's good to see like more nimble, more interesting marketing tactics coming out of crypto, because that's really a lot of what it needs. But I don't know if anyone caught the recent promotion for DYDX is offering a $75 credit, USDC credit, so dollars, right? Not funny money. If you deposit $1,000 of USDC into your account. But the one caveat is it only available to traders that have been liquidated on DYDX in the past, right? Amazing.
Here's your consolation prize.
Yeah, it's your consolation. But if you've been wrecked, here's $75 to come back, right?
Right.
And I don't, I mean, I want to, you know, I want to have fun with it, because I think it's like, I think it's sort of symbolic of like the animal spirits in crypto, as well as the participation. But, you know, let's look at the bright side of this too, is that, and this, you know, you reference this, think about this with like airdrops and incentives, all these metrics are on chain, right? So, yes. So if you have a position on DYDX, I think there's a, you know, I think they have a wrapped Doge on there. So maybe that's most of the people with this redeeming this promo, but think about the incentives that we now have, this data of smart contracts that have been liquidated, right? We don't need identity to assign a financial position, That's on chain, right? So you can offer that to those wallet addresses who have participated in a certain way. So like, so let's like magnify that, right? Like, now you get into incentives around volume, incentives around size, incentives around positions. And, you know, I think when we think about like airdrops, right, mostly people have a bunch of like garbage tokens in their ETH and Bitcoin wallet. But now that we have this level of data on chain for a certain activity, this one was a liquidated position, you now essentially know who that audience is in a, you know, pseudonymous way. So now you can incentivize those people for a certain activity, right? I mean, you could just use your imagination as to what how those people could engage, coordinate. I think it's powerful. And then also too, you know, we think about leverage in crypto, and I think it's aggressive, quasi irresponsible, but look what it's enabling. It's enabling this peer-to-peer financial infrastructure that's never existed before. You know, look at the giant drawdown we had a few weeks ago when, you know, coins got cut in half, Coinbase shut down, Kraken had issues. What happened on Uniswap? It kept on humming, you know, and everything worked, right? Everything worked. And there's a bunch of pundits out there, I won't name names, but certainly guys who are trying to build services and products for the Wall Street types and saying, oh, like crypto's great, but you need this as sort of a cover. And gosh, with DeFi and especially exchanges, you don't need anything. They work better than the centralized version. So, you know, I might mock the DYDX promo. I think it's funny. But at the same time, like, look what it enables. It enables incentives for individuals that had a certain level of participation, right? Maybe it's, you know, you could, like, I go into like, I mean, we can go for days, but like, think about like UMA and all and synthetics, like think about all the things happening there, right? Trading like currencies and real world assets. And now you have identification of those markets and those participants. I mean, there's just so much you can do. So.
And I think, you know, you bring up Uniswap. I think that AMM model, right? That automated market maker model that Uniswap, you know, essentially kind of pioneered, I just find so fascinating, right? At this point, you and I were talking offline about this, but it's almost as if Uniswap, it works so well at this point, right? Compared to, you know, some of the other, call them decentralized trading venues that we've seen over the last couple of years kind of being developed. It's almost like you take for granted that it's there, right? And what's really cool is when you think about, again, we're getting into the incentives and like liquidity mining and yield farming, all these things. But at the end of the day, you're providing some type of, you know, monetary incentive for participation, right? And yeah, supplying some type of, you know, supply side work, right? In this case, being the assets for creating these liquidity pools. I think, and again, this we can spot check this, you know, 5 years from now and come back and see if I'm completely off or a total moron about this, but I think that type of model where you've got a lot more, we'll call it, you know, heterogeneous liquidity providers, right? Compared to what you see even today in like the US equity markets, for example, right? There's really only a handful of really large market makers that, and across a few different markets where liquidity is almost, it's almost phantom liquidity, right? Because when volatility strikes, a lot of these market makers, you'll have these risk parameters trigger. They start pulling liquidity from the market at the exact time that the market needs that liquidity. And you have these really, really large, you know, dramatic sell-offs that aren't just, you know, crypto native necessarily, right? You can see this in the US stock market. We've seen it recently. And so point being, I think longer term, that type of AMM model is really, really interesting. And quite frankly, just cool because you now can have potentially even a better system or better liquidity buffer, you know, during those periods of volatility, because not everybody, for example, during that sell-off, I'm a provider for multiple pools on liquidity on Uniswap. I wasn't, you know, panic pulling all my assets out of there, right? Yeah. And whereas if that's kind of more confined to, let's say, a concentrated group of individuals who are making those markets, you know, You can see those domino get triggered really, really quickly, and then all of them are pulling liquidity, you know, at the same time.
You know, you're totally right. And I tell you what, the iron finance, like that death, it wasn't really a death spiral. It was an organized liquid funded draw down to zero, because those market makers in that AMM were standing ready. I mean, it's, you know, it's what you call lazy LPing. But, you know, if they didn't have the liquidity providers who were the ones, you know, benefiting from this yield farming scenario, the price would have dropped to zero in minutes. Instead, it gradually went to zero over, you know, 18 hours. And I'm not, you know, what's the difference, right? We're splitting hairs. I guess the difference is, in that dramatic move, there was liquidity. There was price discovery. There wasn't a halt by a regulator, right? Mm-hmm. There wasn't a, you know, a tech issue. I think, Binance talked about like having a tech issue on March 13th, 2020, right? Where like, you know, I don't know, it was just selling off,
yep,
right?
Yep, yep.
But the way these AMMs, the way that they work, and maybe the sort of the lazy LP, right? I think Uniswap V3 might change the scenario when you're providing liquidity in a range. And as soon as it gets out of that range, your position, you know, is sort of, you know, not productive. And so maybe that changes. But yeah, I mean, I think, you know, there's one more point here is that this, I mean, the yield farming, we went from like yield farming, you know, inflationary type numbers. We got into double digits with governance tokens, and, you know, Sushi kind of changed the game with, you know, more exponential ones. But holy moly, like, you know, you could earn, you know, your position back on Iron Finance in a day just from yield farming. I mean, it was outrageous. So, you know, what's like incentives? Is that right or wrong? I'm mixed here, right? Because like, let's go back to the traditional world. There's incentives, right? For like, think of like a, if you buy a bond, oftentimes you'll get like a warrant, right? Or an equity kicker. And that's incentive. You know, you're a bond investor. You're looking for debt. But there are incentives sprinkled on top of that to say, you know, here, if the performance works out, if the, you know, this goes as is, then you get more, right? You get more. And there's probably a lot of other scenarios, but, you know, so I think a healthy amount of incentives, you know, in these, especially for like lending's a no-brainer, right? Lending's an order book. You know, I can provide, someone can borrow. And then there's a spread, right? And these crypto lenders are making, you know, pretty healthy spreads. So these incentives, I think are healthy, right? It's sort of like, you know, if I'm a yield farmer, right? Let's make the metaphor like you go to a Lakers game, right? And you pay a lot of money for the ticket. You know, don't expect one of the players to, you know, to let you play the game or give you his car while you went to the game. Be okay with buying a ticket and leaving with like a free t-shirt. Like that should be your kicker.
right.
So when we're, you know, when I take, I love DeFi and it's going to change the world, but these incentives have to pencil, right? These incentives also have to be, you know, it has to be, like an upside that you didn't count on in the first place. I think that's a healthy mix.
Yeah. And I think to your point though, that concept around, let's call it, you know, yield farming and liquidity mining at the end of the day, I think is, well, not only here to stay, but also sets up really interesting longer term use cases for just about any industry, right? Any type of even consumer facing application or industry that is trying to bring people in the door, trying to incentivize more usage around, let's say, that application. Now, all of a sudden, you've got this tool via tokens, right? And you can design these in different ways. They can have different incentives. They can have, you know, discounts programmed into them. Eventually, they'll probably come with more kind of tangible cash flow generating attributes, right? As soon as we kind of get more clarity around securities regulation. But the long-term vision of this is, I find to be absolutely fascinating. It's one of the things I'm most excited about seeing over the next, let's call it, you know, 5 to 10 years within crypto and within digital assets more broadly, is you now have, we're starting to lay the blueprint or the playbook for starting up any type of new company and building incentives around that and using tokens and some type of digital asset to help drive or bootstrap, you know, the usage of whatever it is that you're building, right? Or that application that you're building. I think, again, it just creates an entirely new business model for a lot of people that otherwise, you know, maybe would have struggled to, you know, bring people in the front door.
Right. And I mean, I look at models like, you know, something like even like Curve, right? I think Curve has a good model, or it's just like a, you know, there's a base APY, and then there's a reward on top of that, which is usually modest. And that reward, you know, CRV, like they have an insane supply schedule. I still don't understand it, but you weren't going to make that money anyways in the first place. So might as well use that to do whatever. If you want to punt it and stay long, or if you want to cash it out. Like, I think there's that healthy mix, but like, don't, like, I wouldn't LP into Uniswap with the expectation that they're going to dump their $3 billion treasury into your wallet as an incentive. Like, right. LP on Uniswap because of the fees and the compounding. Like, that's the core of it, right? So, and even in that, like, think about that, you know, in just in basic world. And when I talk to, you know, I think one of the themes we're going to talk about today is sort of like what's happening in crypto and sort of what's reality on the outside. You know, if you can get a 7% yield on US dollars, that's, you know, measured risk, people from around the world would chase that down. Right. And they eventually will become comfortable, right? That's sort of like the DeFi approach, right? And that's available without taking crypto risk, more or less. There's layers to that. But once this industry matures a little bit more with things around custody and, you know, what does money sitting in a smart contract really mean to investors, to custodians, that, you know, those yields will definitely compress. It's, you know, it's law of diminishing returns, but with, you know, negative interest rates in many parts of the world, dislocations and valuations that are purely driven by the Federal Reserve. I mean, look at the equity markets in the last 2 days. You know, the Fed chairman says what everyone was expecting, and, you know, the market tanks, right? So we're just, not to get into that too much, because I know you're the macro guy, so for your expertise. but the dislocation of all of a lot of markets around the world. But at the end of the day, you can get 7% on cash in DeFi, even in CeFi, right? So like, so I sometimes when I talk with, you know, institutional investors, I think that description's out. When I talk to guys with, you know, people with lots of money, that's something that's interesting to them. Right?
Yeah. And I think to your point, you know, one of our kind of long-term base cases here really is, to your point around not only just that low interest rate environment, but also when you look at the performance of, you know, tech versus the rest of the equity market, and you look at just the equity markets in general and valuations and all of that, I really truly think that you're gonna have this cohort of growth investors who, again, are hungry for some type of, we'll call it, yeah, growth type equity play. And when you look at crypto, I mean, crypto is so ripe for capital flows that are looking for, you know, high above average growth opportunities, because one, I mean, the space is, as we both know, it's gotten to the point where I certainly can't keep up with everything that's happening, right? The innovation and the growth around it is absolutely staggering. And at the same time, most of these companies, similar to, you know, traditional, you know, VC, it's almost like liquid VC, right? They're not burdened with a whole bunch of debt. There's a lot of, yes, risk to the downside, but at the same time, you know, if a handful of these projects or applications or platforms or protocols, you know, whichever layer you're investing in, if some of these really do take hold, the actual, we'll call it P&L of the protocol in and of itself, right? I mean, they're relatively low operating expenses. They're eventually going to be decentralized by nature. And so you almost have this pure kind of cash flow going to potentially some of these token holders, and you do it in a way in which it's permissionless and anybody can participate. So you open up to a global market that, to me, from a kind of growth investor standpoint, becomes really, really attractive. Not to say you just throw money at any project that comes across your radar, but that kind of backdrop and that dynamic against a backdrop of, you know, a lower growth environment in traditional markets.
Yes.
It's kind of the perfect storm for bringing more, we'll call it, you know, institutional quote unquote capital into this market, but really more capital in this market with people who just have, you know, a lot of money.
Yeah. Oh, you're spot on. And I think, you know, a couple observations there is that, you know, what one thing I've been saying since, you know, 2015 when I got into this space is, you know, that all this tech is amazing and these assets are groundbreaking. But and the products, the apps, the services that will have the biggest impact will be the ones that abstract away the blockchain mm-hmm. and abstract away a lot of this volatility, right? So you know, I'm, you know, certainly all in on crypto, but I think more global adoption, especially on Ethereum, will likely be just integrating, you know, interacting with the financial primitives for maybe not real world assets, but just different assets.
Yeah.
You know, they're not going to be counting on, you know, sushi token incentives. They're going to be counting on yield spreads, right? They're not going to be, they're going to be providing liquidity, you know, not for governance maybe, but more so for fees, right? And if they can do it in a market neutral kind of way, the way that market makers do in the real world, mostly, they're going to participate and many already are. So, you know, that's why I just come back to, you know, I always sort of tease that, like, you can earn 7% on your US dollars, you know, and that usually, like, but how, but what's the catch? And yes, the catch is you have to be comfortable with essentially crypto collateral in some cases, not others. But I feel like that, you know, we have sort of the, you know, the Bitcoin, ETH, you know, exposure, and that's happening with institutions, is happening with 3IQ funds, right? But I think more importantly to your point, once we have this inclusion of institutions participating in something like DeFi, they're not going to be interested or counting on gains from asset appreciation.
Right.
They're going to be using these primitives to enhance their business. They're going to be using these primitives for yield, for opportunity. I'll give you know, here's another good example. And I just thought about this the other day. Actually, so I've been, Chris Dixon of A16Z, Andreessen, is like, I've been listening and reading to so much of his stuff. And it's so cool. Like he's a developer philosopher, right? And so he understands it. And he made a point where, like, if you think about, compare tech companies to banks, right? Tech companies right now are very large silos. You know, they have control, political issues. But what do they run on? They run on open source software. I mean, Google's Android is largely open source. You think about Linux and server side. I mean, that's all open source, right? Because that's the developer talent, but that's the efficiency, right? That's an efficiency in the ability, right? So I look at banks and say, you know what, right now banks, they're built on proprietary closed loop systems. And I think that in the future, banks will still be banks. They'll still have a sign out front. They'll still be successful. Everyone needs, you know, wealth management and oversight, but there's going to be open source software inside of banks. Right.
And so, and do you
and
think
that open source software is, It's AMMs, it's peer-to-peer lending, like the way that they execute their trades and their balance sheet will be in this new paradigm that we're working on today. So I think it'll be a lot like the tech companies. They will still have that storefront, they'll still have that brand. Another example, like wealth management, you know, I sit here as like, you know, we're crypto professionals. You talk about like self-custody. Gosh, it's so complicated and it's so difficult. And it's just a myriad of risk factors, right? Kraken, I missed this post. Kraken had a blog post in 2016. And it was like the 40 easy steps to self-custody. And like one of the steps was like renounce your citizenship. You know, it's like extreme stuff, right? So it's hard, right? And that's what, you know, Promo 3IQ, these funds make it, it makes it easier, right, for that. So that's one point. But I think the from managing, like just managing my own crypto, right, it's difficult. So I look at things like Zapper and this Argent and then even like SET protocol for diversification fund management. Like I need those tools, right? And those things, those meta level tools that will interact with Uniswaps and the compounds. We need those. So that's where banks could play that role for, you know, the world's wealth. It sits on top of these decentralized systems.
Right. So rather than, let's say, displacing all of what a bank is or what a bank does, you know, the future of banking essentially gets innovated on or improved upon and still exists to a certain degree, but it's built upon, you know, these permissionless and, let's say, decentralized networks and rails, you know, underlying.
Right. Right. I mean, we're still going to have these lines in the sand across countries and regulation and tariffs. And so, you know, banks will manage that stuff. But when it comes to the execution, right, instead of SWIFT, it'll be Lightning. Right.
Yeah.
And that'll be a fun time.
One thing I love about, you know, you and I catch up pretty frequently. And one of the questions we're always kind of kicking back and forth is, given your insight into and conversations you have with, again, we'll call it quote unquote institutional investors, there's obviously a lot of discussion in the media and there's headlines around what, you know, an institutional investor really thinks about crypto, DeFi, Ethereum, Bitcoin, all of these different things. Is there anything or any conversation you've recently around, you know, anything that's jumped out to you or surprised you around what the real behind the scenes conversations look like with some of these institutions, right? And I guess my question is, what are these institutions? What do they really care about? What are the kind of biggest concerns? What are the kind of things that are top of mind for them right now as they start to evaluate whether or not to come into this space?
Yeah. No, I mean, that's a how much time do we have? That's a loader.
Enough.
I mean, there's so many things you could go after. One is, you know, they want access to global assets, right? And they can get it. You know, we have prime brokers and Goldman Sachs. I mean, you can get exposure to any asset, you know, in the world, whether it's direct, whether it's derivative, whether it's, you know, a collateral against, like, you know, there's a lot of opportunity out there for people who have that, right? And so right now there's just this, you know, they're, like you said, I mean, there's just a new generation of growth investors. There are, I mean, we won't get into sort of like global debt and negative interest rates, but, you know, the idea that these big institutions have obligations, right? That they're not currently meeting. And I'm not saying that Bitcoin fixes that, am I? But they have to look at other sources. I mean, how about this? Like, who's investing in Tesla? At everyone, right? I don't understand Tesla. I understand Tesla as, like, you know, okay, they make, you know, make cars and batteries. But in terms of the valuation, in terms of management, talk about management, you know, guy's obsessed with Dogecoin.
Yeah, Elon's playing his own game. He's just playing his own game.
He's playing his own game, right? And like, and so like, I go back to my days of like, I used to work at, I was investment banking at Bank of America. And I would research these companies. We did a lot of debt issuance. So I was like a credit guy. I would have to know the inside and outs of these companies. And I thought I did, right? But then something would change. And I was like, wow, like, I didn't see that coming. And if I have that level of insight into one company and I still don't have my hands around like the moving parts, you know, how is the world comfortable with a stock like Tesla with a, you know, this benevolent dictator? Let's kick that over to Elon. This sort of interesting cap structure, like if the world's comfortable with something like that, then clearly they can reach out to something like a potential digital gold, right? An aspirational digital of gold, as I think Fidelity Digital Assets coined it, right? So, you know, Bitcoin definitely has that allure of a new asset. And, you know, you can slap labels on it all day, right? Store of value, you know, future of reserve currencies, digital gold. I'm not really sure what to call it, but I do know that, that it has finite supply, it has interest, it will have more applications, and it's pretty straightforward, right? So it's pretty easy to wrap a thesis around it, especially when you have regulated funds that offer it, right? So, but when we get into Ethereum and describing the investment thesis for Ether, it becomes a little bit more complicated. But it also has a shift in the investor, right? The investor's like, I want to learn more about this new paradigm. I want exposure to this new, paradigm and all the things sort of like built on top of it, right? So, I mean, if we think about if Bitcoin is this sort of aspirational store of value, digital gold, which, is it panning out to be so? I'm not really sure. But, Ethereum as this like shadow financial infrastructure, right? Like it can operate parallel to the existing financial infrastructure and thrive and multiply from here, right? That, and then most importantly, all those applications built on top of Ethereum, all the things we've been waiting for since, 2015, remember identity, remember advertising, remember, all this provenance of blockchain, all that stuff. None of those apps really came to market. Those were ideas. And today we have apps on DeFi that work, that are liquid, that have $60 billion of locked up, that are real. And so, you can't ignore that, right? You can't ignore that. I don't know, I struggle to sort of frame like the exact like investment, opportunity. It's really just a participation. And these banks are watching it closely. They're tiptoeing in with, you saw with Goldman Sachs this week, and what I read in their report a few weeks ago, yes, they're going to make exposure of Bitcoin and Ether available to their clients, but it's mainly in a derivative form, right? It's mainly in futures and options. And I think that that's, we can dig into that more, but that's the starting point, right? But gosh, I mean, all the things that are happening that make sense, right? Lending, market making, derivatives, like all these things have such a big market and it's coming. So, the smart bankers are paying attention. Many of them, I've seen a number of them sort of get involved and then, bounce and join Delphi Digital, right? Or join 3IQ. Like that's happening. That's happening daily, and it's beautiful.
It's funny. I don't know if I've come across somebody who's started to really dip their toes into crypto and specifically DeFi, who's come from the, let's call it traditional finance world, that hasn't wound up staying in crypto and getting involved in DeFi. Once they get a taste of it and they kind of see, see the light, they're all in, right? They see the opportunity.
The other line I've heard is you've never and this is real, you think about the Bitcoin pundits, rarely have you heard a very negative viewpoint from someone who's done their homework, right?
Right.
Like you hear, I mean, let's leave the Bitcoin ESG stuff aside because, there might be something, pretty important there. But the pundits, like some of the guys I used to talk to about like DeFi, that wouldn't hold up. DeFi is not going to hold up in a down market at all. And I have two excellent examples of that happening. Right, March 2020, and a few weeks ago.
Battle scars to prove it.
Yeah, and so I'm not like mocking the pundits of what we're doing, but gosh, I would love to just hear an educated thesis against not just Bitcoin, not just ETH, but like against being involved. Right, someone saying, I've understood this. I've done my research. I've read all the Delphi Digital reports, and I still think it's a big waste of everyone's time. Like Noriel Roubini and Warren Buffett and some of these others. It's a narrative, right? It's a narrative in support of their agenda. Better or worse, But like, I'm looking for the educated antagonist. You know, yeah. That's what I want to hear, and I've yet to really hear one.
Yeah, and I think part of it too, just in conversations I've had, is it almost seems like it threatens the knowledge moat for some of these people, right? It's obviously a brand new type of asset, or call it an asset class. It's both a combination of, you know, you can apply traditional financial metrics to it. You have now, to your point, a lot of on-chain data that we can start to, you know, build out and quite frankly, we can start to model. And at the same time, there is a lot of risk and uncertainty around some of the tech that's being built, right? Yes, it's been battle tested at this point to the degree in which I think you could certainly say that we've the train has left the station and we're not going back, right? Cat's certainly out of the box. But at the same time, to your point, I haven't really come across somebody who's done their homework, especially that is at that kind of pedigree in terms of, you know, influence and right. notoriety, and has turned around and said, yeah, you know, it just X, Y, and Z reason doesn't make sense to me. Right.
Right. Right. I've heard it from like people who look at Bitcoin as, you know, a real like commodity like asset. And then they say, you know, Ethereum's not for me. I've heard people look at Ethereum and say, you know, this is going to change the world, but you know, Bitcoin is something with less interest. Like I've heard sort of that. And again, you know, that's coming at it in two, they're two very different, you know, let's get at this, right? Like what are your crypto politics, right? Yeah. You gotta pick one. You gotta pick the red one, or you gotta pick the orange one or the blue one, right? Why do we have to pick, right? So why do we have to say, like, because, you know, Bitcoin and Ether as assets have they're so different mm-hmm. and they're attacking, you know, two different things, right? So when I, you know, if I were to frame my sort of preference for these assets, you know, I'll straddle the fence, right? I'm like I think Bitcoin has the attributes for the digital gold. Great. It's not there yet, but it will be. And I think Ether and Ethereum and DeFi can change financial infrastructure. So, you know, if we put it another way, if we look at it from like politics, right, that I'm fiscally conservative and I'm socially liberal, right? And I get mocked for that too, but it's in the same sense of like, I think you can do both. Right. I think you can have your cake and eat it too. Right. So it's like, it's sort of, you know, another one is like, I'm a big Clippers fan, but I also like the Lakers, right? Two great teams. Why do I have to choose? Why do I have to pick, you know, a side? It was Sue from Three Arrows. I was listening to his podcast, a great one. Uncommon Core, I think it's called. Mm. And he was getting into how there's, you know, sure it's divisive, but like human nature is competitive, right? And we always tend to think in the sort of an American view of thinking is there's got to be a winner, there's got to be a loser, right? There's got to be my viewpoint, and then there's got to be someone else's, and that's not really how markets work, and that's not how like competition works in the real world. So you know, I think we have to one thing I think you have to wade through the agenda. And, you know, I try to put my own agenda aside and be open to what's out there. But when you hear the voices, when you hear the influencers, when you turn on CNBC, everyone's got an agenda and they're going to share that either, you know, all in or rat poison or this or that. And I think that's a fool's errand.
Has this concept of maximalism that you're hitting on here, have you seen that deter, let's say, large, sophisticated institutional investors who were once maybe looking at this space and then saw, let's say, somebody who's very, very, you know, one-sided, you know, called a Bitcoin maxi, know, some of the commentary that comes out of that kind of turn them off from this, because it is, it can almost seem, I don't want to say cult-like, and there's certain arguments for that being one of the reasons why crypto is so resilient, because at the end of the day, a lot of Bitcoin's built on a belief system, right? One that you and I both very much believe in. But the people ask me, what is the biggest risk to Bitcoin? And aside from, you know, some broad-based regulatory headwind, it's honestly something that could derail the commitment and the enthusiasm from the Bitcoin community that believes in, you know, this new type of digital asset. And for me, at least, it's this kind of step function change around communities and this whole movement towards, away from, I guess you'd say, the corporate incumbents, towards a more kind of collective or community feel where, you know, tide lifts all boats. But at the same time, the people who come in and say, or from the outside say, this isn't worth my time, I challenge them to come in and say, and look at some of these communities and get involved in some of these communities and tell me that you would bet against an asset class that has that much enthusiasm and that much commitment to, we'll call it, this longer term vision. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I do, but I don't, I think that's more of a retail issue. I don't think pension fund managers are reading, you know, Twitter with Peter McCormick talking about, you know, the world's, you know, reserve currency. I think we, you know, this is part of like, let's zoom out. Let's be open to the world. Let's talk about reality. And crypto Twitter is just not reality. It's where things are being built. It's where ideas are being shared. It's where, you know, alpha is being, you know, discovered. But it's not framing the global narrative for Bitcoin. It's just not. I think people like Michael Saylor tend to have a bigger voice, and that might dissuade some people because, you know, he is very, you know, sort of, he's said he's open to all new technologies and this is the right one today. But, you know, he has an agenda, the biggest balance sheet of Bitcoin, right? So I don't think so. I think some of the bigger issues, like, gosh, like you think about like Aave, Compound, and just lending, Uniswap, you know, market making. Like, I wish those could be elevated and featured. And some of the others are, you know, washed away, because then it becomes, you know, I'll give you another example. Like my class, I teach adjunct professor Pepperdine. My class is called Digital Asset Finance. And what I find a lot is, you know, the students, they're like, hey, great, Bitcoin, that's great, Ether, okay. But what's next, you know? And I call them the treasure hunters, right? They're looking for the next big thing. They're looking for the undervalued thing that's going to pop, right? And, you know, no, look no further than the Wall Street Bets crew and even some of this NFT stuff, right? So they might go into Twitter and look at Iron Finance and be like, let's try yield farming. And we see how that wound up. So I think that, like, I don't think it's about narrative. I don't think the narrative is tainting global adoption of Bitcoin, because, to be honest, like, the world doesn't go on these Clubhouse chats, right? A lot of the narrative is in a silo, and I'm sort of thankful that that's happening. The issue becomes when we have like these bigger blowups. And then, you know, Mark Cuban starts talking about regulation of stablecoins. And, you know, we have, like, in Canada, there was the Quadriga CX and lots of people lost money, right? I think that's the biggest risk factor. It's real loss of money. It's not a cult-like sort of influence. It's dollars and cents, right?
Something you just said that I definitely want to come back to is, you talk about with your class, right, and your students and Bitcoin and Ether, and now they're looking for what's next. And it sounds like it's almost like Bitcoin and Ether are old news, right? They get it. They want to move on. They want to find the next big thing. Have you found that compared to, because I think you sit in a really interesting position where you have conversations on one hand with institutional investors, and on the other hand, you have it, you're teaching a class on digital asset finance to students. Do you find that the, I guess, reception or ability to, for digital assets to really click is a lot quicker with your students versus some of the institutional investors, because maybe some of them have grown up, they're more digitally native, or is that not something that you say?
You know, it's a great question, because I'm gonna go the other way on this. You know, my students are they're smart, they're eager. I think 80% of my class is already invested. I had two students who were already working in crypto. You know, this is and then I taught the same exact class last year. This year's class was oversubscribed. I had like five people auditing, which they're not getting credit. They're just listening. And then last year's class, like this is maybe this is a new index of like investor sentiment, right?
This is your year over year.
My poll, I'll do my Zoom polls of my class. And it's like last year, it was like half of the class was invested, which is, I thought was still a lot. But they were mostly like, you know, green when it comes to knowledge. Mm-hmm. This year, 80% of the class invested. I've got two people working in crypto. I had two guys who were, you know, hacking something together in DeFi. Like, we've come a long way, right? So, but, you know, I guess this, and this relates to the last question. So here's what I find. I find that the students are very much like crypto, to the moon, coin flipping, Robin Hood pumping, news chasing investors, right? And I say maybe that's a wrong characteristic because it's a very broad characteristics, but like, but it's they are typical of like the crypto Twitter audience, right? They eat it up, and that helps me because it helps me with like with you know, what are these. They're very vocal in what they're thinking about, right? They're thinking about NFTs, they're thinking about Dogecoin, and you know, for better or for worse. So when I start with them, I have to come back. My first class is entirely spent on what is money and monetary systems and the Federal Reserve and the payment systems. Like, I don't even say Bitcoin on the first class. And I think that took a lot of people by surprise. I have them read, this year was Saifedean's The Bitcoin Standard, which is an excellent book. And everyone, like that's what, you know, if you meet an institutional investor and they want to learn more, give them that book, right? Because it is the backdrop, the macro backdrop, the history. And then you sort of pair that with like the history of like technology, and it just makes total sense. So I have to zoom them back out into like the macro picture and like why, and not just for Bitcoin, right? But for like, you know, for DeFi, it's like, how do these financial primitives work today, right? Like, how do derivatives work? And where do you get leverage? And, you know, and then once they have that baseline, then we can introduce what the better version looks like, right? So it's, you know, I'd say half of my class is just typical fundamental economics and finance. And then the other half gets more into crypto. So that's where I think, like, that's where, and Joe Rosenthal from Bloomberg, I think, you know, he's sort of all over the map as well with his sentiment, but I think that he's getting into this narrative that, you know, stop pumping these coins and start looking at how it can affect the world. Right. And I think ever since he had Hayden from Uniswap on their podcast, I think he's really like looked into, because he's a Wall Street guy, right? He understands it all. And then he's like, coins are great to the moon, but like, holy crap, look at this, you know, look at this $40 trillion derivatives market. You know, it's the largest TAM in the world. So, you know, I like to zoom people out to that level.
I guess it's a double-edged sword too, right? It's almost like you want to have your cake and eat it too, with permissionless networks and decentralized networks in these systems, the ability for anybody to launch their own token, right? And put whatever design or we'll call it quote unquote, you know, intrinsic value behind it or value you try to build into it. The fact that you can do that in a much easier way than obviously going to a stock exchange and saying, I want to list, you know, on your exchange and have my asset be tradable. You have to almost expect that we're going to get, you know, a lot of these, you're going to get a lot more noise in that type of market. But at the same time, the trade-off is you have a lot more innovation and composability and new ways of doing things. That is, you know, people have obviously often compared this movement to you know, the advent of the internet and, you know, early 2000s tech. And for us, obviously it's an acceleration on top of that because one, you already have those primitives built for you. But two, these concepts of composability just makes it, it by nature makes that innovation happen that much quicker because the feedback loop is so fast.
It's so fast, faster than any other industry we've ever been in, right? Like this is, you know, let's say crypto in general is driven right now by open source software and greed and the largest addressable disruptive market in the world. Like those three things to iterate on open source and new projects to, I say greed, I mean, you're incentivizing people to participate. And I think that's like, you know, that's a big driver of this. You're gonna have casualties, you're gonna have billionaires, but what other market in the world has had that lightning fast pace of innovation? Because a lot of other things, I mean, you think about like autonomous cars and autonomous cars right there. Like it's expensive to build those things. It's expensive to research them. And largely it's happening inside of like Google, Uber, and whomever else, right? So how fast is innovation going to happen with those sort of central players being the key innovators? Today, we have key innovators from all over the world. I mean, I love you listen to podcasts. I'm learning new accents from like, you know, like Eastern Europe and Asia, just because like those are the pioneers in crypto. And that's amazing. Another thing I want to address too, and I struggle with this a lot, is and this is another one from Sue at Three Arrows, is gosh, recency bias is so hard. And I will tip my hat to the Bitcoin maxis with the time preference thesis. I think that could work in all different all different parts of your life, right? What is your preference for your immediate need? And these little supercomputers in our pocket, right? They've made us to be like lab rats, and we respond and we think and we don't think, we just respond, right? Maybe that's it. But you know, the recency bias is so powerful in crypto because we have these ebb and flows where, and Kevin, you've been in it long enough in your career in crypto, where like one day you're like, I'm Jamie Dimon and I'm going to take his office. And then the next day you're like, whoa, why did I ever leave banking? You know, like that happens, and that's a reality, you know? And so this recency bias around like this, I mean, ICOs is a great example. Like I was in the thick of it in ICOs, and I was drinking the Kool-Aid, and I was, you know, and the world was going to change like that year. And that didn't happen, right? And that didn't happen. And then it was like, okay, this is all a scam, right? And so I, you know, come back to where are we today, right? We've had a big run-up, but we've had adoption, right? And you know, Bitcoin's its own thing and Bitcoin's fantastic. But like with DeFi, we have adoption, we have real world applications. And so, you know, I think we're trending down in terms of like the market price. And I absolutely expect the narrative to go back to DeFi's a scam, it's Ponzi, all these things are worthless, let's get back to work, right? I have a mentally prepared for that narrative. Yep. And that's that recency bias that's just so strong in crypto. So it's I don't know how to fight it, right? You know, you just sort of have to elevate back up and just say, like, here's the addressable market, here's what's happening, and the real things that are happening.
And there's a lot of things that feel very different today, obviously, versus, you know, your post-op blow off in 2017, right? Early 2018. But one of the big things for me is directly to your point of, not only do you have adoption today, I at least personally can actually see where, or at least think I can see where this really goes mainstream and actually, you know, changes the world. Yep. Versus 2017, Bitcoin, I think I got a little bit early just because, again, I was more kind of familiar with macro. And that's actually what turned me on to Bitcoin, was I thought it was very fascinating in a more macro context. Some of the we'll call it, you know, more crypto rabbit hole type things, you're diving into DeFi in the very early stages. I kind of saw the writing on the wall of what it could look like, but it really, I won't say it didn't click for me, but I wasn't entirely sure that this would actually become something, right? I wasn't sure if this was just going to be, you know, a fad, or if this is really going to be something that took off. And since, you know, making that full-time plunge into crypto a few years ago and now sitting here today, I mean, I honestly can't imagine being anywhere else or doing anything else, because it's almost like, you know what I mean? It's like that conviction keeps you know, your head down during these types of times. You have big sell-offs and a lot of volatility, and you say, listen, like, we're building for the future. And then I really truly believe that that's kind of where we stand.
And some of the best, like, you know, another thing is the, I think relevant here is, what is it? The Lindy effect, right? The longer you're around, the more powerful it becomes. I mean, look at Dogecoin, right? Like, it just sort of sat there and no one cared about it. And then all of a sudden, boom, it's back because it was there. Right. So, that's one sort of, I think, you know, shallow example, but another good example of like OpenSea. OpenSea was building NFT platform when no one cared about NFTs, right? And they were hard at work and they were heads down. And I wouldn't take an investor meeting with them just because I'm like, there's no market, you know, good luck. And so they've built a marketplace that when that tide turns, they're right there. You know, so like, you know, that, I think that's the, you know, you as a venture capitalist, right? That's you probably have that mindset as well around like, okay, what's here today, but like, what's around the corner? And, you know, you may not have that conviction. This is where I come back to Chris Dixon, because like, I don't think like him. And that's why I love reading his stuff. I love his podcasts. And because, you know, he's 5-10 years out. He's 10-15 years out. And I can get like 5 years out, especially with just like the financial stuff. But that's like, gosh, I think that's where special things are built. You know, Uniswap is another example. It was just sort of tinkering around with like this new, you know, primitive when DeFi was, or when crypto was in a bear market, right? And then it just had its moment to shine. So, you know, one thing I would say, you know, I kind of went through this thing with NFTs. Like, they first came to market and I was like, oh, wow, that's cool. Like, let's look at it. And then it, you know, it got abused. You know, there was so many, you know, out of work graphic designers are like, hey, I'm going to upload my entire hard drive to this thing and, you know, and see how it does. And, you know, no one bought their JPEGs. The things at the top sort of, you know, the cream rise to the top. Right. But, you know, now I'm thinking, and I had a meeting yesterday with some Hollywood types and some big investors, and they want to get into NFTs, right? So I'm the NFT guy apparently. But it's like, I'm kind of peering around the corner to what the promise of NFTs hold in the mainstream. Like, let's get out of crypto for a second. And I think it's going to enable a lot of interactions, especially with like marketing and incentives, but on a mainstream basis. We're seeing a little bit of, you know, a great example of like, so I guess kind of finished with like, I think the NFT sort of art investment thing, like that's a thesis. But when we get into like DAOs and like second level engagements and even like, you know, the Turing complete smart contract can basically do anything, right? So imagine, you know, what Fox Studios, who just raised $100 million to create an NFT studio, like imagine what they're going to, who knows what they're going to dream up. But, you know, in my own mind, I think we have to abstract away sort of crypto from NFTs, and it'll just become like ownership, right? It'll just become a world with obscene levels of digital redundancies and distractions. You know, we'll now have this scarce level of ownership of a lot of things. And, you know, there's a lot of big money paying attention to NFTs right now. Mattel is launching stuff, but I think the stuff today is just like, I don't want another JPEG. Like, that doesn't work for me, right? Like, so the what is it? Maroon 5 just launched this week.
And I was kind of excited. I don't like Maroon 5. I don't know who does. Adam Levine has like a big, you know, he's a big personality, right? They did their campaign, their NFTs, right, on Yellow Heart. And it was, buy this JPEG, great. But if you buy this, it unlocks that. Okay, now we're kind of like, if that, then this, right? That's sort of the premise of a smart contract. Interesting. And then it was like, DAO, we're going to create a Maroon 5 DAO that's going to do ESG and like buy this seed unit and there'll be different phases. And I was like, wow, that's like really cool. So I went on and bought one for like $25. I checked back 4 hours later, there were 7 people that bought it, right? 7. And I think today there's like 40, you know? So unfortunately this whole campaign with Maroon 5 is like a complete flop. So what does that tell me? It tells me, one, they probably don't have the cult following that like an NBA Top Shots have. But two, gosh, we're just so early in what's possible and what people want to do, but what the market, right now, NFTs is largely surrounded with, you know, with crypto and crypto and then speculation, right? And I think this is a good attempt, but this is that moment where it's like, that's like, this is where the world is moving, but we just need better experiences. We need better on-ramps. We need all this. And
I wholeheartedly agree in the sense that I think tokenized communities, and let's call it community tokens with a DAO at the center, and then complementary NFT strategies kind of built off of that, right? Yeah. I think that is very much the future of how a lot of this starts to pan out.
And it's the present too. It's the present. Yeah. I mean, one more example from this meeting is that I was talking to them about, you know, they're like, oh, Maroon 5 artwork, cool. Next level, wow, DAO. And they were like, what? You know, and I kind of talked them through it and they were like, okay, like fun, but like, I don't know if that's going to happen. I was like, guess what, guys? There's $3.5 billion locked up in Uniswap's DAO. There's $1 billion in Aave and Compound each in their DAO. Like, this is already happening. This is already reality. This is already being battle tested. And that's like, for me, that's like setting the stage for something much bigger, right? It'd be different if Maroon 5 had no precedent for like creating a DAO, but now there's billions and billions of dollars locked into these organizations that are just so, so creative and so enterprising. Same with like the NFT apps, right? They're here today. So it's just like, what's the application in the future? So
And I think that's a great segue into the final kind of question I had for you, which is, and to put you on the spot a little bit, based on all the things we're talking about, what do you see as, or what do you personally think is the most interesting part of crypto that you're watching today, or the most interesting development that you think is going to happen within crypto that you are, let's say, most excited for in the future?
I think there's some near-term risks, right? And there's some near-term risks within regulation. So kind of back up too, like I'm in Canada. I'm an American. I moved to Canada from California last year. And I sort of call myself like I'm in regulatory exile. I'm not leaving anything, but guess what? I'm halfway to Seychelles. Like, Canada is regulatory friendly to Bitcoin crypto investment funds. And so I'm going where that opportunity is. I probably won't go all the way to Seychelles, but I think that there's opportunity, you know, nearby. Canada has cleared the way for these crypto investment funds that are regulated, that are audited, that have oversight, but they're also cracking down on, you know, on crypto ownership by corporations and by, you know, they went after Poloniex and recently, and there's been a lot of guidance as to how public companies can use and manage crypto. So it's a bit of a push and pull. But I think in the U.S., you know, it's sort of a, you know, I think we recently heard VanEck approval has been again postponed, kicked down the road, and you know, I call it the $50 billion question in the U.S. for crypto funds, right? The SEC asks, are these funds, quote unquote, like designed to prevent fraudulent, manipulative acts? One, two, Do the practices, do these funds allow to protect investors in public interest, right? They're holding on to those two things before they open the floodgates to crypto and the regulated, you know, venues. And, you know, I don't have an opinion either way on that, but, you know, I've met Gary Gensler before, and I don't know if anyone, you know, Bitcoin MIT conference, he's been there almost every year. And I kind of go back to like the example of like when I worked in investment banking, I knew so much about these companies, but what I really knew is how much I didn't know, right? Yeah. The more you learn about something, the more you realize you don't know. And that's alive and well in crypto. So I look at Gary Gensler and he's, you know, he taught at MIT. He knows about crypto capital infrastructure. He knows about leverage. He knows about incentives. He knows about all these failures and all these hacks. And so he's seen how like the sausage is made inside. And I think that maybe he's become a vegetarian. So, you know, I don't know if I maybe does that hurt or help, get, you know, for example, an ETF approved. I don't know. It's a bit of a coin flip. So I think there's, and then a lot with like, I think a lot of these big, you know, hacks, rug pulls, bank runs like Iron. And I think those are bad. We got to get away from those, or at least, you know, if they hit the press, this whole Bitcoin ESG thing is a near term risk, right? But what am I saying is the opportunity? I mean, the opportunity, it's funny. Someone else was saying the same opportunity. Like sometimes the best thing in investing in crypto is to just do nothing, right? Don't trade. Just like you get in, you allocate. It's like one of those slow cookers, right? Set it and forget it. Sometimes that thesis has worked, where I think when you divert from the large caps, historically, it didn't pencil, as opposed to just staying firm. So I think staying firm with assets that, you know, again, not really investment advice, but you know, go with the large caps, but I guess I just gave it. What's exciting, I think, is just like more involvement of what's already here, right? What's already here. And there are other things that need to be fixed. Custody is still not there, right? On an institutional scale, even a personal scale. So that needs to be fixed. And then user experience, like my whole thing around like when Facebook DM, I think it's called now, you know, I was seeing that as not like, okay, I can make payments, but like now the world has a Bitcoin wallet. Like for me, that was a huge catalyst. And I think for the market ran too, right? So, you know, we have to have those user experiences that are just easy. And unfortunately, those are held with big tech, big banks, and a lot of the case, you know, big funds to allocate. So we need those easy user experiences. And so what does that mean in terms of investment? It's just sort of like, stick around. You know, it's the Lindy effect. The longer you're in crypto, the more battle-tested, you know, you become. And then, you know, on the, you know, in NFT, I'm not getting too invested in NFTs. I'm just sort of observing. But that's going to have mainstream adoption. Look at NBA Top Shots. I mean, there was an example. My sister-in-law, she's a nurse in surgery. And she was the doctor. They were supposed to do surgery, and the doctor was in the break room. And they're like, "Doctor, let's go." And he's like, "Hold on." He's on his phone. He goes, "They're about to drop. You know, new Top Shots are about to drop." Like he was delaying surgery to get his Top Shot, right? So for me, that was like, oh, okay, this is real, right? So I think the NFT will do all the things that we all know, right? Like allow artists and curators to sort of come closer together, but like the marketing applications of user engagement, understanding the user relationship, back to the DYDX, right? Like knowing which investors were liquidated and providing just those people incentive. Like take that with NFT and say, You know, just those people that join the Katy Perry fan club are going to be entitled to X, Y, and Z. Like once you have those marketing applications in a form that's just like off your Facebook account, right? There can't be any static, you know, sprinkle on a little speculation. I think that market will be exciting.
Yeah, no, 100%. I often joke that anybody new who's curious, remotely curious about crypto, whenever I get in a conversation with them, I probably say the coolest thing about crypto is followed by something. I probably say that a dozen times. And I also think that probably the coolest thing about crypto is something I might not even know about crypto, you know, and I find that also fascinating too. So it seems like it's certainly a matter of when, not necessarily if at this point, which is nice.
And then the one I mentioned before of like yield on dollars.
Yeah.
Like that's disruptive. That's available. You look at what Circle's doing. Coinbase is now offering, you know, loans to, you know, their clients. I mean, there's going to be a large sort of lending and borrow landscape within dollars inside of crypto. There's yield there. There's significant mm-hmm. yield there. And so, you know, this is where it's like abstract away the memes, the dogs, the food tokens, and come back to like borrow, lend, you know, be a market maker, be a, you know, funding rates, like these traditional primitives are 100x improvements in DeFi and, you know, participate. And I think if we're doing it, then it's only time until bigger balance sheets do.
Yeah. No, completely agree. I think that's a perfect place to end this one. Really appreciate the time, Tom. For anybody who is interested, learning more about you, learning more about 3IQ, where should we send them?
I mean, you know, 3IQ, Canada's largest digital asset manager. You can go to 3IQ.ca, but you can always get in touch with me. I'm on Twitter at Tom Lombardi. Looking forward to it.
Awesome. Well, Tom, thanks again.
Thanks, Kevin.
I really appreciate it, man.
Yeah, that was fun.
Looking forward to the next one.
All right.
Have a good one.
See ya.
Before we go, we'd like to thank our sponsors for making this episode possible.
There are several projects building inter-blockchain communication protocols, but there's one that's currently built. Cosmos.network is on a mission to link every blockchain. Well-known projects like Terra, Band, Kava, and Secret use Cosmos and the Cosmos Hub to connect to every other chain in their network. The Cosmos Hub is completed and launched, and you could visit cosmos.network today to check it out. The Cosmos Hub brings us that much closer to Web 3.0, and we thank the Cosmos community for sponsoring the Delphi podcast.
With a proven track record of delivering products safely, the Kava platform is DeFi's most trusted, scalable, and secure institutional-grade cross-chain engine. In addition to the protocols Kava and Hard, the Kava platform is launching Swap Protocol, a cross-chain AMM liquidity hub bridging DeFi, blockchains, and financial services to swap the world's largest assets and maximize yields across your entire portfolio. Try for yourself or learn more today by visiting kava.io. Celo is an open platform for mobile-first DeFi with a vision of bringing decentralized financial tools and services to anyone with a mobile phone. Eco-friendly, Ethereum-compatible, and governed by Celo holders, Celo's proof-of-stake consensus mechanism and automatic daily carbon offsets make Celo the world's first carbon-negative blockchain, offsetting over 2,200 tons of carbon to date. To learn more about how to lend, earn, and stake with Celo's growing family of platform-native stablecoins, visit Celo.org today. Hey, everyone. Thanks for listening to the podcast. If you enjoyed it, please support the show by hitting subscribe on iTunes, writing a review, or sharing this episode on Twitter and LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our next episode out soon.